ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
What if living offline isn't a choice anymore? I'm Ray Johnston, and in Opt Out, I'm finding out just how much of our lives are online and whether we can ever really unplug. From privacy experts to hackers, we explore what it means to disappear in a world that's always watching. Opt Out. To hear it, search for Download This Show wherever you get your podcasts or hear it on the ABC Listen app.
So Priya, we've discussed before our common preferences for pets.
We have.
And in fact, it's got a few listeners up in arms, some of whom have actually written physical letters to us complaining about our anti-catism.
I don't know why you're bringing it up again, given the mail that we had, but alas, here we are.
Do you have a dog?
I have two dogs, Chook and Wally. They're beautiful dogs. They're very old.
Are they well?
Our little one has cataracts and our other dog has alopecia.
Right.
Yes. So you're taking a full history.
So you're exsanguinating money into your veterinary surgeon's
profits. No, they're okay. They're well, I have to say. Support them.
Well, we're going to be talking today about a dog that's getting very exceptional service from his owner. And it's coming up on the Health Report.
And it involves AI. I'm excited to listen. I'm Priya Alexander on Wurundjeri Land.
And I'm Norman Swan on Gadigal Land. Also on the show, your GP might not notice your liver function is declining because of the way laboratories report blood test results. We delve into that issue.
The National Disability Insurance Scheme has been around for decades, but we're going to hear the story of someone who didn't have access to that support and what it was like navigating life with disability. You've admitted last year that sometimes we can be quite sceptical, and perhaps AI in healthcare is one of those places where I'm a late, if not no adopter. But it is an evolving area. AI is really getting its tentacles into healthcare, and we did do an interview with Professor Enrico Cuera last year on scribes, if you recall, which generated a lot of discussion.
A lot of GPs are using them. We should just explain what a scribe is.
Yes. So 4 in 10 GPs are now using them in Australia, an AI-powered scribe. And what that is a device that's on the computer in the software that helps the GP or any medical professional take notes. It listens to the consult. It generates notes. Some scribes will just do that. They will just write some notes down. Some will actually offer diagnostic input and potentially skew the direction of the consult. Some of them will actually generate letters and send a letter. For instance, if it's a non-GP specialist, a surgeon, it might write a letter back to the GP. So they can do a lot of things.
Yeah. And here's the good side. The good side is that inevitably the AI scribe will record more of the conversation with the patient than would be taken down in notes in the short time you've got after the consultation before you need to see the next patient. You'll tend to write down the important stuff, but sometimes the important stuff is buried in the conversation itself when it comes to the next visit. For example, you can predict pancreatic cancer from the pattern of GP visits over a period of about 6 or 8 months prior to the diagnosis. And that's buried in the conversation when the person's come in maybe for something else or tummy ache that sounds more like an ulcer or dyspepsia or whatever. And so you miss those patterns which the AI scribe can actually pick up and point out. But the problem is there are also problems with AI in medicine potentially, and it's going at an enormous rate, you know, into diagnostics, into consumer-facing websites where you can, in theory, diagnose your own condition, which goes beyond Dr. Google to a level that you would have been hitherto unimaginable. But the problem is where it's been trained and what it's been trained on. So if you've got an American system that's based on the American healthcare system and also American English, you actually may not have an AI system that's fit for purpose in Australia. Mm. And it may even be that if you've got an AI scribe that's been trained in Melbourne, it might not work as well in Bendigo or another country town because the way people speak, their life experiences are different, and the AI system is really only as good as the way it's trained.
I mean, Enrico did delve into that in the interview that we did last year, but I think when you said it takes notes and perhaps gets more detail, the question is, Norman, what detail is really needed in notes? Because I've had reports of some colleagues sharing with me that the Scribe generated a letter back to the GP, and it contained all of this extra information in the consult where the patient had said, you know, I've just had the death of a loved one and it's been a tricky time, and it's all picked up in the note, and the patient hadn't necessarily anticipated that.
And might not want it to be shared either.
That's right. And so the real thing with AI scribes, as you said before, it's rapidly evolved. The horse has almost bolted in some respects, and now the regulation is trying to catch up, and the TGA released its kind of regulation of AI in July last year, already when it was being widely used. But it's on the onus of the health professionals to consent every single patient, not just a poster on the wall. And RECO did say that, and the ARPRA guidelines say that too. The medical board's regulation says it can't just be a poster or a piece of paper that they see at reception. You must say to the patient, are you comfortable with me using it? And you must check the notes really carefully and actually go through it and ensure that it's all accurate.
Do you use it?
No, I don't. I still haven't, because I use the notes and my writing time to think. And for me, that level of control is important. I don't think I'm going to do it, Norman, ever. Is that possible?
Yes, of course it's possible. Anything is possible.
With Norman by my side.
Whether or not you get a humanoid robot sitting in your office one day and you wonder who it is.
But do you know what Enrico recently said at a conference, and I saw his comment, was that he would really like these AI scribe companies to actually publish their performance data, to say what their error rates are, their rates of hallucination, which is where the AI actually generates text that's not based on anything in the consult but actually generated by the AI itself. But Enrico is basically calling for far more transparency on the performance of these products. How good are they?
So this is evolving. It's rapidly evolving. The horse proverbially has probably bolted to some extent. And what we might cover this year is what impact AI is having on medical research, because that is considerable and some of it actually is worrying.
And if we are pitching things for this year, I'm very interested in ChatGPT being used for people for their health questions, because recent data suggested up to 70% of people who use ChatGPT actually go to it for health queries. So I just want to know, what does that look like?
And ChatGPT being used for psychotherapy.
That's it.
People talking to it, and well-documented case of suicide in a young man in the United States. So there are real problems there. The guardrails, which are there with some of these AI systems, can be got around.
If there is anyone who's using AI in any form for addressing their healthcare needs, maybe you're the person using it for psychology support or asking it some medical questions, we would love to hear from you and potentially explore all of this for 2026. Our address is healthreport@abc.net.au.
This is ABC Radio National and you're listening to The Health Report.
I believe that you have something else that I need to be worried about.
Just tell me here now, you know, just be honest. You come into the surgery and one of the things you've got to do at some point is you've got to go through all the blood tests.
Before I consult, actually, I'm in there an hour early to do this.
And you're not getting paid for it, but you're looking through the blood tests. What are you looking for?
So it's not just blood tests. So if I may give some context here, there's a full inbox.
Is this you wriggling out of what
no,
I'm about
Norman,
to say?
No, Norman, I want to answer the question and I certainly will. Okay. But it is a full inbox, often with hundreds of things, and it's non-GP specialist letters, x-rays, pathology, and you have to go through and decide who you're going to send a text to come in, who you might deal with on the phone, who's an emergency, and what you can just clear. You don't have that much time. And I will look in the pathology realm for things that are bolded, highlighted, that tell me it's outside the reference range.
So just to explain, you're looking down a list of numbers and the pathologist will put something that you should pay attention to in bold lettering or numbers with an asterisk beside it.
That's right. Sometimes it's red, depending on the lab. And often the pathologist will leave a lovely note helping me interpret the result if it's ever needed.
Right. So that's what you notice. And then the rest of it just goes in the bucket.
Well, if it's not bolded truly, I think most health professionals checking results would say if it's not bolded, asterisked, yes, I might look for their renal function if they're on certain meds, but otherwise I need to have a really quick, efficient system.
And that's what this story is actually about a very serious condition, which is damage to the liver caused by what we'll call fatty liver disease. We'll find out more about that in a minute. It's very common in the community. And this started off with an email, in fact, a set of emails from one of our listeners who was telling us this story about a liver function test. So this is a liver blood test, and it was done on her partner. And it's called ALT, alanine aminotransferase. So when your liver cells get damaged or inflamed, this spills out into your blood. And his ALTs were not bolded or asterisked. They were within the normal range of that lab. But it turns out they were actually abnormal.
So in fact, this person's ALT was actually increasing slowly over time, but still within the reference range.
Yep. And he ended up with what's called hepatic encephalopathy, where in fact the toxins from your liver gather in your bloodstream and could affect how your brain worked. So this listener has been on a mission to actually get more attention paid to how pathologists report on this ALT test. And this rang a bell with Professor Simon Strasser, a hepatologist, a liver specialist, director of the Liver Foundation, who is dealing with this day by day, the variation between pathologists on ALT reporting in relation to fatty liver disease. Here's our conversation.
So we've seen a very dramatic change in liver health that parallels the rise in obesity and type 2 diabetes in the community. So what we're seeing is more and more people with evidence of fat in their liver, and we call it fatty liver disease or metabolic dysfunction associated fatty liver disease, because it's a liver disease that's associated with having obesity, having high blood pressure, having high cholesterol and triglycerides, having type 2 diabetes, and the liver dysfunction is a manifestation of that. And we see it both on ultrasounds, where we see fat in the liver, and we see it on liver tests, where we see mild derangement of liver test abnormalities. Now, in some people, they just have fat in their liver and their liver function otherwise is maintained. But in some people, they actually will get inflammation in the liver building up. And over time, that inflammation will drive the development of scar tissue as well. Now, the reason we, as a liver specialist, I worry about fatty liver is on a number of levels. One is it's becoming one of the commonest causes of liver cancer, and you don't have to have cirrhosis in this context to actually get liver cancer. It's also becoming one of the commonest reasons that people are needing liver transplantation. And that's a big change because now we've got good treatments for hepatitis B and for hepatitis C, that they're becoming less of a reason for people needing a liver transplant, and causes such as obesity, diabetes and fatty liver disease are becoming the more common causes of people needing a liver transplant.
And my understanding is that the damaging effects of alcohol are multiplied. In other words, you need to drink less alcohol to get serious effects on your liver if you've got fatty liver disease than if you don't.
Correct. All of that is compounded in terms of risk for developing more scar tissue on the liver and increasing the risk for complications with cirrhosis and even liver cancer.
Can you have fatty liver disease without obesity?
You can. So about 20% of people with fatty liver disease actually don't have obesity, but they do have the metabolic risks. They're often sedentary. They've usually got a poor diet, and they usually carry excess weight around their middles, although their overall BMI or body mass index may not get them into the range where we think they've got obesity, because they're carrying it around their middle in particular. And when you carry fat around your middle, you also carry fat around your organs and in your liver.
Which brings us to the blood tests. So often when your doctor's worried about you or you're getting a general checkup, they'll do a spectrum of blood tests. They'll do your hemoglobin, your red cells and your white blood cells. And often liver tests are part of that spectrum of tests that they'll do off a single sample. And the question here is about the liver function tests that are reported on. And our correspondent to the Health Report said there are issues to do with one of the key liver function tests, which is called ALT or alanine aminotransferase. You should just tell us what this test is. And her suggestion is that doctors seem to ignore it when it's high and don't respond appropriately.
Well, I think partly that's because it's very common to have a slightly elevated ALT level. And what ALT is, it's an enzyme that sits within the liver cells. And if the liver cells are damaged in any way or inflamed in any way, it will release out into the bloodstream. Now, the problem is partly how the laboratories report the ALT level. Now, the fatty liver disease that we talked about, at least a third of the Australian adult population has fatty liver disease. And by some measures, it's up to 40%. So it's very, very common. And one of the markers of that may be an elevated ALT levels. The laboratories report out ALT levels with a normal range. There'll be a lower end and there'll be particularly a higher end of that range. And even around Sydney, where I'm working, the ranges from one laboratory to another, for instance, for a man might be 35 in one laboratory and be up to 50 or even 55 in another laboratory. And yet they're done usually on the same machines, but they set the normal range based on a population normal. So if you've got a population where a lot of people have fatty liver, then there'll be a lot of people having what's thought to be a normal ALT level, and they'll report it out up to even 50 or 55.
So if I can just clarify there, I mean, it seems gobsmacking that you can have one laboratory, and the College of Pathologists makes a lot about their standards and how you can trust one laboratory versus another. And what you're saying is this is laboratory specific. Well, that's one gobsmacking thing. The second gobsmacking thing is, well, they're kind of assuming fatty liver disease and adjusting their reporting because they might be in a part of Australia where there's a lot of fatty liver disease and therefore the normal has changed upwards. But that's like saying a normal cholesterol 6 when we know that a healthy cholesterol is below 5.
I know it makes no sense to me because we know that in fact a healthy in a woman should be 19 or lower. And in a man, 30 or lower. That's a lot less than the normal ranges that we get from the laboratories. So as a liver specialist, when I look at liver tests, I'm looking for much lower levels than what will get an asterisk or a bold mark on a report. So if I see, for instance, and we see this all the time, for instance, in people with hepatitis B, I'll see a young Asian woman who has chronic hepatitis B, which is a virus infection of the liver, and her ALT will never be above normal, but it might be, say, 32, and they'll have the normal upper limit of 35. I give her antiviral treatment and settle down the inflammation. The next time she has a blood test, it'll be 15 or 16. So even though that ALT was originally in the normal range and didn't get an asterisk, didn't get a bold mark, it's halved by the time we've given just an antiviral tablet to reduce that inflammation. And we see the same thing happen in people with fatty liver disease. We see they've got obesity, they've got poorly controlled diabetes, they go onto a medication, it drops their weight, controls their diabetes, and that ALT level will fall, even though it's always been within the so-called laboratory normal range.
So what's to stop us saying, well, here's the normal value and it's reported accordingly? Why don't we have that for ALT?
Well, we do within the liver specialist mindset.
But isn't your mindset the one we should be following rather than random pathology?
Yeah, I think we probably should be. And when we do education and set out guidelines for general practice, we have those values incorporated. And in our new metabolic associated fatty liver disease consensus statement, those values are in there, but they're not the laboratory normal ranges that the laboratories are setting at. And so nuancing results for the actual individual is very important. I guess when we're reporting out of laboratories, we're also trying not to scare the entire population. So if you suddenly reported abnormal ALT on a third or maybe 40% of the population, what does that drive in terms of health utilization? Well, for an individual, it would say there's something actually, your liver's not completely healthy. You should be doing something to assess for whether there's scar tissue present in the liver, and we've got ways of assessing for that. And you should be looking at the metabolic risk and trying to lower that for the benefit of future heart disease or future diabetes development. So we look at the liver in a way as being sort of a canary in the coal mine. It may be the first indication in somebody that metabolically they're not healthy, and that if they start to introduce some ways of getting themselves better, improving their diet, reducing their saturated fats and their sugars in their diet, getting their weight down, exercising more, that overall metabolic health will benefit and their chance of getting diabetes and heart disease in the future will reduce. That first hint of that might be from an ALT that's towards the upper limit of that population normal, or that there's a bit of fat on an ultrasound.
So it's a complicated conversation with your GP. I mean, your GP said, well, I'm going to do a test on you, and you don't ask any questions about it. You know, they know they're doing the tests and they're doing the right thing. But there's a series of questions. I mean, which lab are you sending this to? What's their normal value? How are you going to know that I'm raised but below that level? I mean, what do you think is the conversation a person should have with their GP when the GP is embarking on liver function tests?
Well, I think somebody should know what their ALT level actually is. The laboratory ranges worry me less because they vary so much, and yet I think it's the ALT level itself that's the important number.
And sorry, just to clarify, because I might have misled people listening to our conversation, is the assumption here is that the pathologist is actually coming up with an accurate ALT level. It's the interpretation of that ALT level that's the issue.
That's right. It's the normal ranges vary. So for an individual person, if they're worried about their liver health, knowing their ALT value is actually probably what the important number is. And for an individual, it may be the first driver that says, actually, there's something not quite right with my liver. I'm going to work hard to get my weight down, to get my exercise levels up, to look at the components of my diet and start eating healthier. And that will improve things. And an individual will see that ALT level will actually fall if they do those things. And at the moment, we have no specific treatments for fatty liver other than looking at those lifestyle things. If we get onto these earlier, we can prevent those outcomes.
Professor Stibon Strasser is at the University of Sydney and Director of the Liver Foundation.
On Radio National, you're with the Health Report.
So now to that story on dogs that we promised earlier. This is really a fascinating story. It's about a very special dog owner, and you'll find out why this dog owner is particularly special, who has been using high technology to try and get better and more personalised care for his dog's cancer. Our reporter in this story is our trusty producer, Shelby Traynor.
She's kind of an interesting dog, very intelligent, very calm and collected, but if there's a cat nearby, she'll love to bark at it. Very, very affectionate. As most dog owners will probably tell you, and I'm slightly biased here, is for every 10% you give them, they give you 100% back. And it's like that with Rosie.
This is Paul Cunningham, and he's talking about Rosie, his rescue dog.
She had just turned 2 when I got her, and she's just about to hopefully get to 8.
She's half Staffy and half Sharpei.
Both of those breeds are predispositioned to getting the kind of cancer that she has.
About a year ago, Rosie was diagnosed with mast cell cancer. Mast cells are part of the immune system.
When you get a runny nose, that's actually the mast cells making your nose run.
And mast cell tumours are the most common malignant skin tumour in dogs.
Mast cell cancers, when there's been a genetic mutation, they're constantly receiving the signal to just keep growing.
Rosie has undergone several surgeries, immunotherapy and targeted anti-cancer therapy. Unfortunately, while it has extended her life, the cancer continues to grow. And so Paul took matters into his own hands to find a treatment that targets her specific genetic mutation, which is known to be implicated in unfettered cell growth.
Because if I didn't try, I'd know that I hadn't tried everything, essentially.
Paul isn't an oncologist or a geneticist or a biologist. He does, however, own an AI company. And that means he has access to tools that many people don't.
With some of the knowledge that I knew about these recent breakthroughs, I thought, like, why not give it a crack?
Oh, my initial thoughts were this probably hasn't been done properly. You know, this is really difficult science.
This is Dr. Kate Mickey, a structural biologist at the University of New South Wales. She saw Paul's work down the line, more on how he did it shortly, but she was amazed at what he was able to achieve.
Genuinely surprised, like he's done an amazing job. And I think that's something that's really exciting and inspirational to me, to see a member of the lay public, you know, without formal scientific training, being able to get so far down the pipeline, essentially unaided, which I think is a really interesting reflection of where we are.
I jumped on ChatGPT in November 2024. You know, there's like 2 to 3 hour deep dive sessions you have with ChatGPT, one of those sessions, and came up with a plan on steps to take. The first step was to get Rosie's DNA extracted.
This was done during one of Rosie's surgeries. The veterinarian kindly took a sample from the cancer and a healthy sample. Paul then reached out to a research institute that agreed to extract Rosie's DNA from both of these samples. It's a multi-step process where the DNA is isolated and purified.
The next step was to get the DNA sequenced.
DNA is made up of 4 chemical bases: adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine, or simply put, A, G, C, and T. It's the order of these bases that essentially determines whether you're a person like Paul or a dog like Rosie. Specific strings of DNA contain instructions for building things like proteins, which carry out vital jobs in the body, including activating mast cells. After the DNA had been extracted, it was the University of New South Wales that sequenced it turning Rosie's DNA from a biological specimen into data.
Now we have the data. The data was about 350 gigabytes.
You might think of genetic sequencing as an exact science, but it isn't. This 350 gigabytes of data has to be sifted through for duplicate readings of DNA strands and rearranged to reflect what a typical dog genome would look like. This was done on both Rosie's cancer sample and her healthy sample before the two could be compared.
We ran what's called variant calling, looking for differences between the two. And this is where you can find the mutations. We focused in on a protein called c-kit. It's a known cause of the type of cancer that Rosie has. Once we got the c-kit protein, the healthy one and the mutated one, we used this new technology, which I was aware of, called AlphaFold.
So it's a computer program that was written by the DeepMind team at Google.
When Paul says they got the c-kit protein, what he means is they found the sequence of chemical bases, the specific jumble of A, G, C, and T that instructs the body on how to make the c-kit protein. However, proteins aren't a jumble of letters. They're three-dimensional structures.
An age-old problem has always been we know what the chemicals inside the proteins look like. It's like a long string, but we've never understood how they fold up into a three-dimensional shape that carries out the machine task that they do. And that's important for us to understand because if you want to make a drug, almost all drugs target proteins, and they target the protein by binding selectively to the particular machine protein they're looking for that stops it working.
That's where AlphaFold comes in. It's an AI program that's able to predict the structure of a protein based on the sequence of chemical bases that it's fed.
Prior to this moment, so for the last 60 years, we've had to do it by experimental methods. I personally have spent my life working on solving protein structures, and I've worked for 4 years to try to get the structure of one protein and not been able to achieve it. They're very difficult. So AlphaFold software, it's an amazing tool in the hands of someone who understands protein structures to really accelerate research.
This isn't software you can run on your average computer.
It's very expensive and calculations run for hours.
Despite this computing power, Dr. Mickey says AlphaFold is far from perfect. It makes mistakes. When AlphaFold gives predictions, it also provides metrics to tell you how well it thinks it's performed.
It's a bit like putting the power drill in my hand, right? I'm not trained as a tradesman. If you give me a power drill, I can drill a hole. It's probably pretty ugly. The best place for the power drill is in the hands of a master craftsman who it really accelerates their job. So as a structural biologist, I can look at the results of the program and understand the things that we can trust and the things we believe and the things that are useful and the things that it's probably not doing a good job at.
Whether or not AlphaFold has done a good job, it has given a prediction of what Rosie's mutated c-kit protein looks like. The reason this was so important to find out is because it could help Paul find a targeted treatment for Rosie's cancer that works, because it binds to her uniquely mutated c-kit protein and can stop it from running in overdrive.
Mast cell tumours are very common in dogs. They're rare in people. So it's not an area that medical research is going to spend a lot of time investigating.
Peter Bennett is an associate professor in veterinary oncology at the University of Melbourne. There are two drugs for dogs that already do target the mutated c-kit protein responsible for out-of-control mast cell growth. However,
even the dogs with those mutations don't always respond to that inhibitor.
Which was the case in Rosie. So Paul went in search of a drug that might work on her exact mutation, a kind of personalised approach that isn't usually available to dogs. And he has found a promising compound that is in use in humans in the United States. And he did that with the help of even more AI programs.
It's like AI within AI within AI. So we've got ChatGPT guiding the whole steps we need to take here. Then we got AlphaFold allowing us to see these amazing protein structures so that we can even do this. Then we're using other AI inside this to actually like search for novel solutions.
However, after all this work and all this discovery, there's a hitch. The drug that could help Rosie isn't approved for use in animals, and the drug company won't budge.
Which is really sad, but it is what it is. I can understand from their point of view, if they were to approve the use of it and it had negative results, it could generate a bad story and they want to avoid that at all costs.
Paul is also aware that even if this drug did work for Rosie, it was never guaranteed to cure her cancer.
cancer cells, unfortunately, are very good about developing ways to become resistant to treatment, no matter which form of treatment we use.
And there are likely many mutations driving the growth of Rosie's tumours, not just one. But Paul says his work still sends an important message. Look what's possible for a layperson to do with emerging technologies.
I'm not a trained medical professional. I'm just a data scientist slash entrepreneur, and I was able to do all of this. The other key thing here is this would have taken years in the past, and it took me 4 months.
To be honest, like, I'm genuinely astounded at what he's achieved as a layperson. I don't mean that in a condescending way at all. It's a really deeply complicated space.
It also goes to show both how far we've come with personalised medicine and how far we've got to go.
Absolutely, we're in the day of personalised medicine. Like, this is real. So what he's done is not super far-fetched. It's just that cancer's really hard.
Paul acknowledges it was always a race against time because cancer grows exponentially. But technology is also advancing fast to try to meet the challenge.
It's in my nature to not take things standing down, I guess. Like, if you're asking if it's just a way of coping, potentially, but I would way rather try and see what I can do as opposed to just sit on my hands.
Paul Cunningham there, finishing off that story by Shelby Trainer. And the only comment I'd make on that is that we think that genomics is straightforward and AI is straightforward. And what that story illustrates is that there's still a lot of judgment involved.
On Radio National, you're with the Health Report. The National Disability Insurance Scheme is a world-leading program, and there are very few parts of the world that have got anything like the NDIS. The next story you're going to hear highlights exactly what it can do. For the past few weeks, we've been hearing from Kylie and Gillian, who are friends who had strokes 20 years apart. When Kylie had her stroke, the NDIS didn't even exist, but it wasn't until her friend Gillian had a stroke that she realised how much support she was missing out on. Here's the fourth and final episode of A Stroke of Luck.
My best friend Amanda tells these stories of when I'd first had my stroke, and I had told her and my husband not to help me, that I could do these things on my own.
Right.
And she took me away from the hospital for the day. We went to the Blue Mountains, and I got out of the car and I fell. And Amanda was just standing there. I mean, all these people must have thought she was a terrible person. And I looked at her and I said, well, aren't you going to help me?
And I remember saying to you, well, are you going to ask me? And you just went, okay, yep. Can you help me? And I went, of course I can help you. You just have to ask.
And the kindness in actually not helping me,
yeah,
and letting me attempt to prove my point. But it's knowing to ask that's the big question. I mean, that's something I've learnt in the last few years.
When you had your stroke, the NDIS didn't exist. So in some ways, that kind of help didn't exist.
I had health insurance, but I didn't have any other support. As far as having a cleaner and having somebody to take me out to see people and do that, there was none of that. These things were a matter of you do them yourself or you don't get them. Yeah, you just block that out. And I suppose that, Jill, when you had your stroke, it suddenly allowed me to come to terms with my own stroke.
I think I thought about reaching out to Kylie actually when I came home from hospital.
Because you sent me an email.
Ah.
I rang you straight away
and
we talked. And then I got off the phone and I was just in shock, and it just brought up so many memories for me because I'd just been carrying on, getting on with life and doing all of this, and I hadn't actually reflected back on the stroke. But talking to you, all of a sudden it brought all these things flooding back, which was really quite difficult at the time.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I only applied for the NDIS once I'd gone in touch with you. you told me everything they had done for you. And then I thought, oh, this could be incredible if I could just get a fraction of that help. And then to apply for the NDIS and be told that, no, you're not eligible because you've gotten along this well so far, so why would you need help now? That was my first attempt with the NDIS.
You know, she is able to do things, whether it's cleaning the house, whether it's cooking a meal. It is more difficult and it is much more draining and more tiring.
When you finally got in, I noticed a shift where you were, like, a lot happier and you got to, like, think about all of these positive ways that you can improve your own life and have help in dealing with the stroke instead of battling it by yourself.
They sound like small things, but just by having somebody to come in for a few hours a week and clean the house, it lets me go to the physio and see people and do other things. They have totally transformed my life in the last 2 months.
And it's interesting because my experience with the NDIS has been so supportive. I came out of hospital. Basically, the carers were in our house from day one. My hat goes off to you. That has been such a hard, like, I just can't even imagine.
I achieved a lot of what I've achieved because I've had to. But I could have done it far more easily if I'd had the NDIS back when I had my stroke.
Yeah.
But then in raising the kids and everything, that would have been significantly different.
Mm.
You've just always been there for us, been able to take care of us. And as of recently, just sort of been able to appreciate all of everything you've done for us. And just trying to help you out, do little things for you to make it a bit easier.
I think particularly with my husband, it was such a change for me and him, where he went on to be the prime breadwinner and he also became the prime carer for my son. So it altered everything. What's interesting about it now is that I would say it's one of the best times in our relationship. It almost took me to become unable to work that he was able to step up. And we've been married for 14 years and we've been together for 20. Like, that is ridiculous.
You know, we've both had to cope with it, but I think we're both aligned in the change of thinking that, you know, the money wasn't the biggest thing, your employment's not the biggest thing.
Mm.
Conversations have changed too about how do you participate more meaningfully. And I know that's a big journey for you at the moment.
And probably, if I'm honest, when I had the cancer and I was saying, I'm going to change everything and I'm going to be a different person, I really focused on me. I was still trying to do everything by myself. And it's only since I've had the stroke that it forced me to be different.
I guess our friendship, from going from having the power breakfast and everything, has changed significantly.
Yeah.
But we've reconnected just as if we were talking yesterday about the power breakfast and today it's about the stroke.
Yeah. And it's almost like the power is still there.
Yes.
But it's about a different life now.
That was Kylie Betts and Gillian Coates, and earlier you heard from Kylie's husband Chris, children Beren and Corey, and friend Amanda. You also heard from Gillian's husband Steve.
On ABC Radio National, this is The Health Report.
That's it for The Health Report for this week, but don't forget our sister podcast, What's That Rash, where we answer the health questions that everyone is asking.
This week you might be wondering where to put your time and energy with your New Year's resolutions. So we're answering the question, what's more important when it comes to your health, diet or exercise?
It's a big one. I don't do New Year's resolutions, do you?
No.
Oh, there you go. We've just but still listen, it's worthwhile.
It's an exercise in disappointment.
It is, I agree. We can have a chat about that another day.
See you next week.
See you then.
Thank you. You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.